The Basics of Genetics, Lecture 8, DNA.
DNA, or deoxyribonucleic acid, is a beautiful molecule and a fantastic molecule as far as what it does and how it essentially choreographs all of the genetics that we've just been talking about in the last seven lectures. And when do you think it was discovered? You're going to be surprised at this date. 1869, by Dr. Friedrich Miescher, who was a Swiss doctor working in Germany. And he was isolating all sorts of molecules, not just DNA, from the pus from surgical dressings. He was trying to get a better understanding of how to treat surgical wounds and the sort of chemistry that would allow him to isolate molecules from something like that sort of tissue was being developed at that time, such that he was able to take some of the white blood cells, that's the predominant sort of cell that would be in pus of a surgical wound, take some of those white blood cells and isolate, among many things, DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. He didn't know what he had. No one knew what he had. He was also isolating other molecules, but he gets credit for being the first to isolate DNA. And what might it have looked like? Well, he described it as looking like a white woolly precipitate in the bottom of his tube. White woolly precipitate. And when I hear that description, and actually when I look at his protocol is fairly easy to find, I realize that what he inadvertently did, of course not necessarily realizing what he had, was he had some chopped up versions of his DNA, because if you're very carefully, when you isolate DNA, it's not going to look white and woolly, but rather like a long, slimy, sort of almost gelatinous sort of a structure. And isolating DNA is something that I'm going to tell you how to do in instructions at the end of this chapter. It's something that I encourage you to do in your own kitchen. It's actually not that difficult. You yourself will see that there's sort of a slimy polymer gelatin sort of texture to it if you do it carefully and if the DNA ends up not being chopped up. And if it does get chopped up, it will feel and look like a white woolly precipitate. By the way, this doctor who isolated DNA, of course, knew nothing whatsoever about its structure and knew nothing whatsoever about what its possible significance could be in the cells that he was isolating it from. Speaking of isolating DNA, not only is it not that difficult and a fairly routine thing to do in labs all over the world, labs always are isolating DNA and then proceeding on to other sorts of procedures as a typical molecular biology technique, but you definitely can do it in your kitchen. And I once actually took a friendly bet from someone that I knew that I could isolate DNA surreptitiously under the table at the Boulevard Diner in Worcester, Massachusetts, while we were having breakfast. I snuck in an ice bucket and a little bottle of ethanol and a starting material. And before our eggs were served, I had isolated some DNA on this little bet. That's how easy it is. You can do it without even looking. Moving on to 1889, various researchers began to examine the structure of DNA by chopping it up into its component parts or bases. Base is sometimes the word used for those component parts. I want you to notice the dates at which the various parts of DNA were discovered and sorted out, and the materials from which these researchers started. So the first base is guanine. And by the way, the letter that we use to refer to guanine is G. And I can tell you that we're going to be using G for it probably for the rest of these tapes. I'm not going to probably ever again say guanine as much as I'll say it right now, because we typically use letters of the alphabet to refer to these bases. So guanine, or G, was discovered in 1850, and it was found in bird guano. That's where its name comes from, as well as various animal parts. Later on, it was isolated from the silvery sheen of fish skin. It turns out that fish skin that is especially silvery is full of guanine. So if you want to isolate a great deal of guanine, that's apparently a wonderful starting material. But very interesting, that name guanine, it's not your imagination. It really does come from the word guano. Now, whoever isolated it, again, did not realize what they had and did not make any kind of connection with the guanine that we now know is part of the very important genetic code. Next in 1885 was adenine, letter A, so always referred to as A. And that came from various animal glands from the slaughterhouse, such as ox, pancreas, and spleen. And to this day, animal glands are a good source of isolating DNA and isolating other things. So that was the beginning of, you know, a lot of use of those sorts of things from the slaughterhouse. Then comes cytosine, or C, 1894. And that word comes from the word cell. So that's a rather unimaginative name. And notice there's no particular connection between these names. There wasn't any kind of concerted effort to come up with a set of names that would fit together in any particular way. These were isolated observations from people. Thymine, 1894, comes from the thymus gland, from calves, from the slaughterhouse. And that's where the name thymine comes from. But as I said, forever after, we're going to call these G, A, C, and T, because they are that important as the major aspects of the information that is contained within DNA and are almost always represented simply by their single letter codes. Now, throughout the 20th century, there was a feeling among geneticists, a very strong feeling, that there must be an information molecule. There must be something that contains the blueprints that we're seeing through all of our genetic experiments, that we're seeing over and over again the results of. We're seeing phenotypes. We're seeing what happens when particular organisms are mated. There must be something with information in it. What is it? DNA was not considered a good candidate because it seemed too simple. In other words, just A, T, C, and G, just four letters of the alphabet, is that really enough information to do everything that we require of the kind of information-rich molecule that is essentially running everything that we know about genetics? So through the first part of the 20th century, DNA was not considered a good candidate molecule. Proteins were considered a better candidate molecule for the information-rich molecule. Why? Because there are 20 different amino acids, 20 different little subunits that make up proteins, and 20 is more complicated than 4. The idea was we're looking for a very complicated molecule. Can't be something with only 4 components. It must be something with 20 components. So for a little while, people were going down a wrong pathway there, considering perhaps the wrong molecule in the cell to examine. 1940s, Erwin Chargaff began to get some important clues about how the A's, T's, C's, and G's of DNA might work, although it was not put together immediately. It was not put together actually until the 1950s. But what he noticed is that when he chopped up DNA, the numbers of A's that he got were approximately equal to the numbers of T's, and the numbers of C's were approximately equal to the numbers of G's. So A's and T's, C's and G's. And this is just counting up the chopped up bits of DNA that he was working with. And by the way, those became known as Chargaff's numbers. Okay? Fast forward to the 1950s. X-ray crystallography was being developed as the latest way to examine the structure of large molecules. And let me see if I can describe to you a little bit about how that works. If you have a very large molecule, think of an elongated molecule, which DNA is, and if you shine X-rays on it and have those X-rays bounce back onto a piece of photosensitive paper or photosensitive material, those X-rays may bounce back in a pattern that reflects what the structure was that they bounced off of. If you can understand the pattern, and if you can understand the angle at which those X-rays bounced from whatever material it was, you may be able to extrapolate back and figure out what your material might have looked like. So people were very excited about this, and there was a great deal of work looking for the structures of big molecules of the cell using X-ray crystallography. And in fact, protein structure was figured out this way. Therefore, it seemed like a very promising way to figure out the structure of DNA. In the 1950s, there were three major groups who took this on as their project, that is, the search for the structure of DNA, using X-ray crystallography as the major way of getting the data that you would need to figure out the structure. And the stories of these players in these labs have been told many times over, and I decided to recommend some books for you to look into this further if you wish. It's a fairly complicated story. I'm just going to tell you a little bit of the highlights of it and give you a little bit of a flavor of how different styles of science and different personalities of science can make a difference as to how that science proceeds. But you may want to read much more about it, and I have some recommendations for what you might want to look into a little bit further. But let's look at those three groups. We have in England, at King's College, Francis Crick and James Watson. Francis Crick, by the way, was British, and James Watson was American, but he was in England having just finished a postdoctoral position in Scandinavia following his PhD. So he was essentially working at King's College. So that's the King's College team, Francis Crick and James Watson. At the Cavendish, which you may think of as sort of a train ride away and an expensive telephone call away. They were not routinely using telephones. They were more writing letters in those days in England, was Rosalind Franklin and Maurice Wilkins. Meanwhile, across the ocean, across the continent, at California Institute of Technology, or Caltech, was Linus Pauling, who had just figured out the structure of protein with X-ray crystallography, and he was in competition as well, but far removed from them, not a train ride away and not an easy phone call away. He was a long letter writing cycle away from these other two. Now, many historians of science have analyzed and dissected the different styles and the different personalities of these scientists. Let me give you a little bit of a compare and contrast between two of the groups. Francis Crick and James Watson were not doing all that many meticulous calculations from the results of X-ray crystallography experiments. Rather, they were interested in something called model building, where they would go down to the carpenter shop, have a carpenter cut out from a piece of board or metal the shape of an A or a T or a C or a G, and then they would spend time playing around with these shapes and seeing what might fit together. Now, let me tell you a little bit about the shapes. T and C are both single rings. So if you can imagine a sort of a ring-type shape, but then cut out from a piece of plywood so that you can actually hold the shape and use it almost like a piece of a jigsaw puzzle. A and G are double rings, so they're bigger than T and C. Meanwhile, at Cavendish, Rosalind Franklin was an expert X-ray crystallographer and a meticulous recorder of data and a wonderful calculator of all of the various nuances that could be brought out of experiments with X-ray crystallography. She was collecting data, and she actually had disdain for premature model building. That is, she would never have gone to her carpenter shop, if her institute had one, and had model building materials built for her before she had every last calculation done. So two different, very different styles. By the way, Rosalind Franklin had been hired by Maurice Wilkins to work in his lab on this particular problem. Meanwhile, far, far away, almost out of sight, out of mind, was Linus Pauling, who was really a serious contender for this, given his previous success with proteins. Now, things began to come to a head in November and December and January of 1952 and 1953. Again, because it will be too much of a digression for this lecture series, I'm strongly recommending some wonderful books on this topic and just alluding a little bit to the sort of competition that we ended up with. But finally, there was a wonderful X-ray image for DNA that actually looked like an X. The actual original photographs looked just like an X that, when extrapolated and calculated by Rosalind Franklin, strongly suggested something helix-like. And this was very suggestive of what DNA actually would end up looking like. But it was Watson and Crick who moved forth very quickly with some information and built some models. And in a relatively short time, once they understood some of the nuances of the crystal structure, and once they understood some more things that I won't get into, were able to actually build the model the way it should look. Now, what was it about the model? Well, the single ring bases T and C and the double ring bases A and G, they need to be fit together such that C's always go with G's and T's always go with A's. So T base pairs with A and C base pairs with G. And what you end up with is a beautiful spiral staircase with the bases looking like steps in the staircase, but an anti-parallel spiral staircase, almost like an M.C. Escher drawing. He didn't quite ever draw this. He'd had a very elaborate drawing of staircases going in all different directions. This would be a little simpler than an M.C. Escher drawing, but very much like that, where you've got one half the staircase going up and the other half of the staircase going down, but nonetheless, the steps, which are A's and T's together and C's and G's together, in fact, are the steps of the spiral staircase. Here's how that paper came out. It came out in Nature, April 25th, 1953, which is essentially the birthday of DNA. And because of the nature of the competition between the groups, it came out as a triple set of back-to-back papers, which is very unusual in science. Sometimes you see double sets of back-to-back papers. You see two papers come out simultaneously when two groups have been in head-to-head competition and both have come up with their results. As a sort of a courtesy to each other, they'll come out with the papers together and they'll be called back-to-back papers. So this is three papers suggesting, unfortunately, some of the breakdown in communication that was occurring amongst the players such that they weren't all able to publish together. So the first paper is by Watson and Crick. The second paper is by Wilkins and his colleagues Stokes and Wilson. And then the third paper is by Rosalind Franklin and her colleague Gosling. By this point, Wilkins and Franklin were not able to publish in the same paper together. Let me read a couple of quotes from Watson and Crick's paper, a couple of my favorite quotes from that. It's a short paper, it's worth looking up and reading, and it's just got some exquisite, tantalizing details about what the future of DNA was going to be. So here's the first quote. "We wish to suggest a structure for the salt of deoxyribose nucleic acid. This structure has novel features which are of considerable biological interest." And thus was launched the whole field of molecular biology. Just fantastic. Yes, the structure definitely had novel features, and they were of considerable biological interest. Here's the second quote. "It has not escaped our notice that the specific pairing we have postulated immediately suggests a possible copying mechanism." Yep, the A's with the T's and the C's with the G's. And that is the essence of the copying mechanism that we will be examining a little further in this lecture. By the way, there was something omitted from Watson and Crick's paper, and that is the word beauty. Apparently, later on, Crick said that he tried to put the word beauty into the paper, but generally scientists don't use words like that in a scientific paper. And so that word was omitted. Now, here's an assignment for you, because we've just tried to do this on an audio tape. Go look at the best three-dimensional model that you can find. Perhaps it will be at a museum, perhaps it will be at a university or college, but do your best. It could even be something from the internet that is showing you the three-dimensional structure, because you will want to see how beautiful that spiral staircase with the A's and T's and C's and G's all interlocking just so can look. Here's a little mnemonic aid for you, too. If I'm teaching this for the first time to people who are not biologists, I say, if you want to remember what goes with what, A and T are both pointy letters, and C and G are both curvy letters. So the pointy letters go together, A and T, and the curvy letters go together, C and G. And forever after, you can remember that. So A goes with T, C goes with G. That's how the base pairing goes. 1962. 9 years later, Watson, Crick, and Wilkins won the Nobel Prize for this work. Franklin had died a few years earlier of cancer. The Nobel Prize has never been given posthumously, so historians of science can speculate what might have happened had she not died of cancer, but there was not a chance that she would have been given it posthumously. The cancer that she had is suspected to have been caused by her meticulous work with X-ray crystallography, because what it entails is setting up an X-ray generating machine behind a screen, but setting up a delicate strand of isolated DNA and then presumably stepping behind the screen in order for the X-ray exposure to occur. But in Franklin's case, she was so meticulous that she may have exposed herself excessively to X-rays by lingering in the room, checking one last time to make sure that the DNA was where it should be before she stepped behind the screen. So it may have been that she got great exposure to X-rays from all her work in trying to work out what the structure was with crystallography. So that's DNA, and let me read you a sequence and tell you what the complement is, just so you can hear the typical cadence of the letters. A, T, C, G, T, T, A, C, T, A, T, G, C. That might be a typical sequence of DNA, okay? I just made it up. It's random. That's typically the cadence of the letters as they come along, and the information is in those letters. Now, if I'm going to make the complementary strand to that, remember, the first strand that I just read off began with A, T, C. The complementary strand is T, A, G. The T goes with that first A, the A goes with the next T, the G goes with the next C. So where I started A, T, C, G, my complementary strand is T, A, G, C. A, A, T, T, G, A, T, T, A, C, G. And on and on. And that's the mechanism that was hypothesized by Watson and Crick and Wilkins and Franklin, that it must be this base pairing such that we can split these two strands away from each other, and each strand should be able to make a complement of itself. A going with T, T going with A, C going with G, G going with C. Keep doing that over and over again, and we have the fundamentals of replication of the major information molecule of the cell. Now, it can be very useful to use metaphors, and I use lots of metaphors. So it's, I think, fitting here to switch to the metaphor of a medieval monk copying a manuscript. Some aspects of this, of course, will not necessarily fit. So as always with metaphors in science, we're going to pick and choose which aspects of the metaphor work best. So imagine this medieval monk. He is copying a manuscript, and he is inadvertently introducing errors. What sorts of errors? Well, some of them are major errors and some of them are minor errors. Let's go through some of the possible errors that this monk could be introducing to this copied manuscript. He could be introducing point mutations. That's what they're called in DNA. That's when we have a letter like A or T or C or G and accidentally substitute a different letter, G, C, T, or A, okay, where there should have been a different letter. There can be insertions. That's when this monk is copying along and accidentally inserts an extra letter A or an extra letter T or C or G somewhere in the manuscript. There can be deletions. And that's when the monk would be removing a letter accidentally, an A or a C or a T or a G from the manuscript. By the way, there is a field of study that involves analyzing actual medieval manuscripts for exactly these sorts of mutations or errors. Actually, they wouldn't call them mutations or errors in transcribing. And my colleague Michael Drought, who occasionally does audio courses for this series, is one of the people who delights in discovering and analyzing those errors. It's one of his specialties. So it's actually a very apt metaphor. And I think when people were first starting to understand DNA and how it works, they turned to this particular metaphor because it was such an apt metaphor for what was going on with DNA. Now, you might be wondering, isn't there some way for this monk to proofread and repair those errors? Isn't there some way for this to occur with DNA if there are errors inserted into a manuscript? And I will say the short answer is yes, there is a proofreading and repair mechanism. And in fact, there's more than one for DNA. And there sometimes are problems with it. It's sometimes called an error-prone system. Sometimes it's not clear as you're proofreading, whether it's DNA or a medieval manuscript, whether you're introducing more mistakes by attempting a repair or actually repairing a mistake and leaving it at that. It really depends on whether or not you understand what the manuscript was supposed to be saying to begin with. So that's kind of a long, convoluted way of saying, yes, there's proofreading and repair, but yes, there are error-prone aspects to it such that even more mutations could be introduced into the system. Now, on a molecular level, thinking about DNA, what exactly is doing this replication or this copying? It's an enormous enzyme complex called a polymerase. Poly, many, and that ace ending implies an enzyme that has some kind of activity. So polymerase, something that is making a big polymer, namely DNA. And what's it making the new strand out of? There is a pool of nucleotides, a pool of A's, C's, G's, and T's, like letters of the alphabet, awaiting use in the cell. And as the polymerase moves along the strand, it examines one at a time each base. If it's an A, it inserts a T. If it's a C, it inserts a G, and on and on and on, thus replicating the molecule. So that's what's actually going on. So medieval monk is to polymerase for that particular metaphor. Replication is important. Mutation is even more important. And mutation is not necessarily a negative word per se. It has taken on negative connotations, but in fact, we are all accumulations of selected mutations. There probably is nothing that you could identify as an original piece of DNA without mutations. So no DNA lacks mutations. And all the variability that we've been talking about, all the wonderful variability of plants and animals, and it's all because of mutations. So I tend to think of the word mutation as a very positive word, and would like to sort of steer you in that direction too. A little later, we'll investigate further what the Oxford English Dictionary says about that word so that you can see how it's come in some circles to acquire some negative connotations. But I'd like to kind of reverse that in this course and talk about it as really a positive thing. Let's think about the cookie factory for a minute. Recall the blueprints for each machine. What are we talking about here? Errors in the blueprints. Errors in the building of the machines of the cookie factory, and therefore differences in what the output of that cookie factory is going to be. Okay? But what you should realize is that most mutations are happening on a fairly low-key level, so that they're closer to being little tweaks, little nuances, slight changes to the blueprint, slight changes to the genes, so that what we're really getting is slightly different flavors, slightly different shapes, the sort of variability that I was asking you to look at in a previous lecture. Look at ladybugs, look at birds, look at flowers, and notice the amazing variability. I should also say, though, that there are certainly categories of extremely negative mutations. They tend to get more publicity. Maybe rightly so. They tend to be studied more, especially ones that are associated with medical problems. And in general, the more negative a mutation is, the easier it is to see. If it's really blatant, then you can see it and you can study it. Whereas some of the mutations that we've been talking about thus far are fairly subtle. You have to sit down and actually count the spots on a ladybug, or actually look at the slight gradations and colors of a flower. So negative mutations often get more publicity and certainly may get more money for research and study. So to go back to the greater context, this copying of genes happens every single time a cell replicates itself. Therefore, it's happening all over our bodies all the time. Every time I make new skin cells, which I'm constantly doing, I'm constantly renewing my skin. Every time I repair wounds, every time I make more red blood cells or white blood cells, which I also do regularly, anytime an organism needs to make a copy of itself in entirety, therefore reproduces itself, we have DNA replication. And every time DNA replicates, there's an opportunity for mistakes to be made. You could think of that poor medieval monk with cold fingers in a monastery somewhere, copying away and repeatedly making different little errors throughout the manuscript as he copies off copy after copy after copy. The way to think about this is it's an entirely routine part of the way DNA works. And if it did not work this way, let's do the Gedanken experiment on that. Gedanken experiment, which I took from the physicists, a thought experiment, the sort of experiment that we do when we can't actually do the experiment. We just sit in our armchairs and think about it. Let's do the Gedanken experiment. What if DNA replicated perfectly every single time? Then nothing would happen. We wouldn't have the diversity of organisms that we have. We wouldn't have any of the structures we have, the wonderful diversity of colors and pathways of genes. And in fact, we'd be at some primordial state close to the origin of life where, for one reason or another, this particular molecule did nothing and nothing ever came of it. So in order for this to be the information molecule for life as we know it, it must have mutations. It goes hand in hand with it, and it's a completely positive trait. Let me tell you about a special kind of mutation, and I put mutation in quotes here in my notes because it's not really a mutation in the sense that we've just been talking about, that really can introduce some amazingly dynamic complexity to this picture, and that is called horizontal transfer. Horizontal transfer. And it's appropriate here as we develop this metaphor of the medieval monk patiently copying the manuscript. What if he were especially creative and every now and then would come up with a little phrase or word or sentence in a different language, like French or German or something, that he just wanted to insert into that English language text? Maybe to make it a little more understandable to himself if he wasn't speaking whatever the language of the text was. That bit of foreign text introduced from a completely different text for whatever reason is what a horizontal transfer is, and it's surprisingly common throughout DNA to have bits of foreign DNA introduced into the main text. So it's a different level of mutation. In fact, it doesn't often get put into the same category as mutation. It's that different. But it's something to think about as we think about the history of DNA and the history of our lineages, that it's not just subtle mutations, but it's also been dramatic changes, the consequences of which can be really far-reaching. If you suddenly have a bit of French text or German text and English text, you've really changed things, and the same has been true in much of the history of DNA. Way to think about it is that we're chimeras. Chimeras from Greek mythology, parts of animals put together into one new animal. Our DNA is highly, highly chimeric. And it's something that we're beginning to understand as genome projects are coming online and people are starting to read genomes letter by letter by letter, just like I was reading aloud a short gene sequence to you, A, T, C, G. As they're reading these, they're coming across what look like horizontal transfer events. So that the conclusion that's coming out of many of these genome projects is that we're all highly chimeric and that our texts have a great deal that is still to be analyzed. So in the next lecture, I would like to tell you more about how DNA works, because so far this has just been about DNA as a replicating molecule. I would like to have us begin to think about DNA as a molecule that is used for information, for building parts of the cell, because that's where we're really going to get into its use as a genetic molecule.
This ends Lecture 8.